But human beings have this incredible capacity to learn. We can learn to be better.
Hello and welcome back. In this episode, I interview Dr. George Simon. Dr. Simon is an internationally recognized expert on manipulators and other problem characters. He's a psychologist and the author of 3 best-selling books, In Sheep's Clothing, which has been translated into 12 foreign languages, Character Disturbance, and The Judas Syndrome. In Sheep's Clothing was a life changer for me when I found myself in a personal relationship with a master manipulator. Dr. Simon's wisdom gave me the perspective and advice I needed at the time to be able to leave that toxic situation. His book was such a lifesaver for me that I reached out to him to see if he'd allow me to interview him in the event that his work might be useful to someone else. And he said yes. You will appreciate George's knowledge. He's a true elder who spent his career studying manipulators, narcissists, and what he calls those with character disturbances who wreak havoc on the lives of others. In our conversations, we talk about the traits of manipulators and the signs of being in a relationship with one who is character deficient. But we don't just talk about the bad guys. He also sheds light on character in general. He shares some of his 10 commandments of character that shines a light on places where we can all act better to bring more happiness to those around us. If you're interested in the subject of character, or lack of, you'll want to listen in. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. George Simon. George, it's so great to meet you. Thank you for being part of the Wealthy Wealthy podcast.
Thank you, Christina. Happy to be here.
All right. Well, I've been looking forward to this conversation, and for many different reasons. And I think there's many different topics we can cover. Where I reached out to you, many times those that are on my podcast, people reach out to me and they, you know, I vet those are going to be on my program to make sure the right match. And then I reach out to some that I really want to interview for my own personal reasons. And you're one of those. So thank you for replying and agreeing to be here with me and all my listeners today.
My pleasure.
And what struck me is I read one of your books. It's called, In Sheep's Clothing?
In Sheep's Clothing.
And it was very helpful during a time of my life where I really needed that type of information. So I think you know where I'm going with that. And that personal relationship and situation was a couple years ago, went no contact and, you know, took a while to heal from that situation. But the reason why is that I think when I found myself in that type of relationship and situation, I had no idea what I was in. And, you know, I went from being who I am kind of today, you know, just professional woman, very successful, independent, made my own decisions, my own character. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And, you know, just living my happy life. And all of a sudden, within less than 18 months, I didn't know who I was. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get out of bed. I lost my self-confidence. I was in a dark place. My health started just, you know, just deteriorating when I'm very healthy. And it just went from bad to worse. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And it wasn't really until I had a friend, actually, once I finally I just didn't keep it private. And I let a friend know, like, what was really going on behind closed doors. And she said, I've been through a similar situation. And here's some books to read. And it's going to bring some light into the situation you're in. And start there. So starting to read some of those books, including your book, is what really opened my eyes of like, holy shit, no wonder. And then trying to get out of that situation, relationship wasn't easy. And, you know, healing from that wasn't easy. But now I'm back to my old self and have, learned a lot of lessons. I wouldn't want to wish it on anyone, but it was something good that happened because I learned a lot out of that situation.
And
but
most probably a newer and improved version.
Such a newer and improved version. I mean, oh my gosh. Yeah. Like, oh my God. It opened my eyes to a lot of different things. So part of what I'm doing now, like a couple years later, now that I'm over the emotional side to it, like I have zero triggers. I have zero anything. Like I really did the work and healed through it, a lot of work. But now I really want to bring, since my friend helped me get out of a really bad situation I wasn't aware of, I want to put a podcast series together that I'll release sometime in the future to maybe help others that find themselves in a similar situation. They're caught up in it and they don't know what the hell is going on. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I know you're an expert in this field. So let's talk about this word that I really think can be overused and everybody's kind of can be thrown into this narcissist type, you know, word that may or may not be true. So first of all, would you just share with the audience who you are, your background, and even, you know, I know you've written many books, but In Sheep's Clothing, what was the background? What caused you to want to write that book?
Okay, so that's a very good question. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I'm just now really entering full retirement. I've been in semi-retirement, not doing retirement very well for the last 4 or 5 years. I had a very eclectic training. I'm really kind of proud of that. I had an opportunity to go to 3 different graduate schools, and the one I ultimately stayed with, I stayed with primarily because the training was eclectic. We got every major perspective. We weren't trained in one school. And that really broadened my outlook. But the dominant school still at the time was a more insight-oriented talk therapy approach that had its evolution in theories of neurosis as opposed to personality or character disturbance. And it was meant for the people who were not very disordered to start with, but just unhappy, having some trauma maybe to work through, some unresolved conflicts to work through. But these were basically decent people that were good candidates for the kind of talk therapy that we've always considered psychotherapy. But increasingly, I was seeing people whose problems in their lives were not so much a result of trauma or some unresolved conflicts or insecurities or any of the things that talk therapy was meant for. Increasingly, I was coming across people who had not evolved into very decent people. However their character was shaped, they weren't very nice. And then I was also seeing their relationship partners. And their relationship partners were suffering from a syndrome we now call the gaslighting syndrome. We didn't have a name for it back when I started to write about it. When I was gathering data for that first book, In Sheep's Clothing, we had no idea what this phenomenon was. I called it that crazy-making feeling, you know, where you just know in the pit of your gut that there's something not quite right about this person that you're involved with, and there's something not quite right about the things they seem to do that manipulate you and make you feel like you're the crazy one. But we didn't have a label for it at the time. I missed that part of the development of things, but I think I was one of the first persons to discover the phenomenon. And as soon as I put it out there in the introductory section of the book, the first book, which we first published independently in 1996, it's a long time ago, the response was just incredible. People said, "Oh my God, that's exactly what happens to me. And that's exactly how I feel." And now somebody with a PhD says, "I'm not crazy." Oh my God. And so it just changed everything. So that's how it got started. And then I started doing much more intensive study of character disturbance in general. All the character disturbances, not just narcissism. And that was the impetus for my second book, which is a much broader kind of expose of the problem. And also along the way, coming to realize why the traditional approaches are no help, and why so many people who manage to find the courage to drag their disordered relationship partner into treatment, and they go into traditional kinds of treatment, why they experience what we now call therapy-induced trauma. They went for help and they end up feeling worse. Maybe the person they were involved with is such a skilled impression manager, able to put on a good facade, charm, et cetera. Maybe they have good seductive skill, whatever the case may be, but things don't go well. And then they end up feeling even crazier. And also the disturbed person gets no better. And for a long time, those of us in the profession were saying, well, it's just that these kinds of people can't be treated. Well, that's a nice thing to say, but the problem really is that you don't know how to treat them. That's the bigger problem. And you don't even know how to assess them. And that's a real strong indictment, I understand, about the profession. And in my early workshops, people walked out. That doesn't happen anymore. But in my early workshops, professionals who I was trying to carry the message to just didn't want to hear it. They did not want to hear it. Things have changed since then, a lot. Now, everybody's an expert on narcissism. It's the diagnosis du jour, as we say. And there's so much misinformation out there that it's not funny. But anyway, I'm trying to do my part.
Well, let's break that down a little bit. Let's talk about, you know, when we're talking about, I think the word that you used was character disturbed, or, you know, personality disorders, or whatever we want to label it. But talk about the specific group of people that hurt others through manipulation, through gaslighting, through just their MO as kind of the self that they are.
Okay. All right. So there are psychological conditions that occur in people who are basically okay as a person, how they want to define themselves, how they style themselves, how they relate to others is perfectly fine, but they're suffering from conditions that are either caused by biochemical imbalances, or at least influenced by biochemical imbalances, and they're affected by circumstances, and they just need a little help. But then there are individuals whose problems and the problems they cause others are a direct result of who they have fashioned themselves to be. They themselves and their way of seeing things and their way of doing things, their preferred way of doing things, is itself the problem. And that, in fact, defines a personality disturbance. Personality these days we define as the person's relational style. And a lot of things contribute to it. Some biological things contribute to it. A person's temperament, the way they're kind of wired and predisposed that way. Environmental factors certainly play a role, how they grew up, what kinds of trauma and circumstances they had to endure. And here's the really sophisticated thing, the harder to understand thing. It's a dynamic interrelationship between those two things that comprise a person's personality. So for example, if you have in a dysfunctional family where there's abuse and neglect, and you have two children, and one is by nature predisposed to be more anxious and more fretful, and is predisposed to be more retreating in their interpersonal style, they are going to develop a much different personality than a person that tends to be a little feistier, maybe is more daring, doesn't have so much what we call adaptive fearfulness, but is willing to try and do anything, is more assertive. These two children will develop very differently in the same environment. So it's not just environment, and it's not just biology, and it's not just both. It's a real dynamic interplay between both. We can't do anything about the biology, nor can we undo the history. But human beings have this incredible capacity to learn. We can learn to be better. And that's what I've spent a lifetime figuring out how to coach people through. And it's really challenging work because the motivation has to be just right. The time has to be just right. A person has to come to that point in their life where they say, you know what? I have for all these years believed that I had it all figured out, but you know, I have to kind of admit things have been a mess. You know, this is the fifth marriage that's failed. maybe, just maybe, I'm doing something not quite right. And then the door opens and then you can get some movement. But the therapy is nothing like most therapists were trained to do. So that's pretty much defined my career right there and my personal mission. I really believe in the importance of character above all else. I think it's kind of like our psychological immune system. It carries us through all the inevitable slings and arrows of life, depending on how much decency is in our character and how much we've dealt with any of the other tendencies, whether there are narcissistic tendencies or excitement-seeking tendencies or other things that contribute to shallowness in relationships. Building character is what it's all about.
Yeah, I want to really dig into character here in a minute. For those that may be listening who, let's say, that might be more in a situation of being manipulated, maybe some type of, you know, emotional or psychological abuse that can't be seen with one's eyes, right? And so can you create a scenario like what it might look and feel like behind closed doors of the person that feels like they're going crazy? And that word crazy, you know, it's a scary word to use because there can be a lot of judgment around it.
Right.
And you know, when
right.
I was in a situation, that's the only, like, I felt I was going crazy. And this is a person that's had her life together, been uber successful, had great friendships, had good children, like everything else was always really good. And then all of a sudden I feel like I'm going crazy. And that was the word I was using to myself, but, you know, ashamed. Then there came a lot of shame and a lot of, you know, I mean, I can just go on and on and on. What would be, what's happening from a kind of a psychological point of view that is creating this situation of craziness, feeling crazy?
Well, let me boil it down to the simplest elements, because it's really kind of complex. But ultimately, the crazy-making feeling comes from the fact that your gut tells you one thing, your intuition tells you one thing. But when you look for objective evidence, especially when you're looking for objective evidence in the presence of a person who has a very strong personality, a very strong ego, and speaks with passion and with certitude that makes you doubt, you feel crazy because you're trying to figure out what's real and what isn't. And your gut tells you one thing is real, but all the other evidence says maybe something else is real. And all of a sudden you stop knowing what's real anymore. So the first bit of advice is trust your gut. It will not mislead you as much as your brain will. And it certainly won't mislead you as much as a skilled but intense and convincing manipulator will. So that's my first rule. Trust your gut. Second is, really, once you understand what makes certain personalities and certain characters tick, once you understand that, and once you get a rudimentary idea of their basic MO, their basic modus operandi, and the strategies they use. I call them tactics in my book. The tactics they use to advance themselves, and usually at your expense. Once you get to know that, you can find some space in your heart to say, okay, there he goes again, or there she goes again, doing that thing that they do. But you know what? I don't have to be swayed by that. I can be true to my heart. I can not listen, not be convinced, stand my ground. And the more you do that, the less crazy you feel. And you can expect them to keep trying. You know, because in dysfunctional relationships with a character disturbed person, regardless of the nature of their character disturbance, they want to continue doing things their way. And for them, life would be heaven if you would just accede to all of their expectations and do things and see things the way they want you to, which strips you of your identity, which is why you have that feeling. All of a sudden, you don't know who you are anymore, right? But once you get that, and once you get that it really is as simple as that, you can let them be them, and you can decide whether or not you really want to have anything to do with them. But you can let them be them, and then you be you, and not feel like you have to subordinate your heart's genuine longings to somebody else's oppressive will. Boy, I've never said it like that before. That must have come from someplace. Anyway.
Yeah, well, you know, part of losing the identity is, and I think that's great advice. You know, I'm far removed from it now, so I'm trying to remember, you know, some of the feelings like when I was in that environment, in that situation. But I was so beat down that I couldn't stand up for myself. I didn't believe in myself anymore. I doubted everything. I really was convinced that I was the one causing all of the problems, everything that was wrong. And it was flipped in a way that it was believable, you know? Right. You know, so it was, at some point I just lost, like to your point, lost identity and lost self that is, I mean, I'm strong, resilient, you know, that's who I've always been. That is my character. And I had nothing. I couldn't stand for myself. Even if I tried, I it was like, I don't know, if you're going up against, if you're a good boxer, but you know, you're with somebody that's going to, you know, twice your size and twice the skill level, they're going to outbox you every time until you just can't box anymore. You know, no matter how many times you try to stand up and put the gloves on for yourself, maybe that's a bad metaphor because, you know, but I mean, so I hear what you're saying, but what would be some signs like to follow your gut? Tell me some of the traits or power tactics. I think that's the word that you use, these tactics that these manipulators use that maybe, again, one, if they're in the situation, they're saying, I see that, I see that, I see that happening. Because a lot of it, like, and the reason why I ask this, again, from a personal reason, is because it was invisible. I did not know this was happening until months and months later when, again, I was deteriorated and I didn't have anything left to try to fight with. At the beginning, I would kind of, you know, I had certain things, but by the end, I think it was just so manipulated and gaslighted and, you know, like I said, so I just had no, because I didn't even know this kind of thing existed, I had no awareness that I was in a scenario, like a pattern that is,
right,
you know, that a lot of people are in the same type of pattern. So what are some signs that one might be able to point to?
Okay, so I really do want to speak to that in just a minute, because that's important. People need to be aware of the signs. And of course, that's why I wrote all my books, actually, every one of them. But I want to mention an important principle first. One of the most insidious things that happens in a relationship with a disturbed person, because their character is not well formed, and because they are comfortable with that, matter of fact, sometimes intensely comfortable with that fact, they're not only happy with the way they have managed to, or how they have learned to kind of control their environment around them, but they're proud of the fact they have pretty strong egos, generally speaking. One of the most insidious things that happens with that is that you keep looking outside for the answers. You ask yourself questions like, why is he or she saying that? Why is he or she doing that? I wonder what's underneath that. Oh, that's the horrible listing, lasting legacy of our former models of psychology is to ask ourselves, I wonder what's kind of underneath that. What wound or trauma or unresolved conflict is driving that? So we look outward for answers. Here's the problem with that. Looking outward is always, it's a guaranteed dead end street. And it incidentally is the formula for depression. It's the only way to get there. So, what's the alternative? Well, the alternative is looking inward, processing what's going on in that gut. Why am I feeling beaten? Why do I just feel attacked? What's going on in here? And giving that validity and staying there and working that through is empowering. So I just wanted to get that in. But how they get you to lose focus and put the focus in the wrong place is with tactics. Like, say, for instance, you confront your relationship partner on something they did that was really hurtful. Well, they all have an excuse for it, you know, and it'll be just reasonable seeming enough. And maybe there'll be just enough grain of truth in it that you think, maybe I was wrong for even bringing up the subject. And we used to think, this is a lasting legacy from the old schools of psychology. We used to think that when people rationalized, that this was an unconscious thing that they were doing to assuage guilt. Well, sometimes when people make an excuse, it's because they want to keep doing exactly what you have called them on doing that is causing a problem. They don't want to admit that they've been doing it wrong. And the reason that they don't want to do that is not so much because they feel so horrible. The bigger reason why they don't want to acknowledge that and correct it is because to do that would be a certain kind of work that they still are at odds with. And that kind of work, modifying my approach in service to the other that I profess care for, that's really what love is all about. And some people are not capable at their stage of character development. Some folks are not capable of that kind of loving. And so they prefer to just validate themselves and their way of doing things, because that notion of doing this work, they can't see how it would benefit them. And besides, who's more important than them and what they want anyway? And this is why the strength of my crusade, this is why I insist that character is so important, and it needs our attention, and it especially needs to be afforded the place in our hierarchy of values that it once enjoyed. There really, really was a time, there honestly was a time when you could close a deal on a handshake and be confident that you weren't going to end up in court. There was a time. There actually was a time when a sports team might know that you had all the talent in the world and could bring it pennants and glory, unbelievable, but you also might tarnish its reputation with your behavior, and so you weren't hired. There was that time, and we let it slip away incrementally, insidiously, and now the most egregious displays of egomania and heartlessness and vileness and bigotry don't even surprise us. In fact, if whoever's doing it is championing our cause, we get right behind them, because character doesn't matter anymore, and we're paying the price.
Wow. So let's just go there. When you say character, define character.
Like personality, which is defined by a person's relational style, character is that aspect of a person's relationship style that pretty much defines how they're doing about getting it with respect to this business of loving. Character reflects one's personal ethics, value systems, moral compass. It's that side of our personality that says how we're doing in this whole enterprise of learning to love. So you can have a personality disturbance and not have a character disturbance. And you can even have a personality disorder and not have a character disorder. But character is the more important component in our day and time. For example, there are certain personalities who are by nature very exacting and demanding. They want nothing but the best, they expect nothing but the best, and they also hold the same standard for themselves. You want that person doing your brain surgery. You want that person, believe me, that's adaptive, right? Because brain surgery is really delicate, and you want that person who's that exacting and demanding. Now, how that translates into how you treat other people in your relationships is a reflection of character. Mm-hmm. So you can have those traits in your personality and still be a decent character, especially once you've come to appreciate more. But forging yourself into that kind of person takes work. If loving were easy, everyone would do it. Mm-hmm. And some folks, and especially the entitled and the privileged among us, who expect a whole lot and don't want to give anything, just haven't found a reason to do that kind of work. Why? And by the way, why should I when everything seems to be working for me? We've seen such egregious displays of this, especially on our political landscape. What reason would any of these buffoons have to change their tact? It's working. So just try to convince them that they've got it wrong and that they need to change course. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And besides which, it's none of your business. Your business is to love yourself, to stay in touch with that core in you, and to take good care of you. That's your business. Mm-hmm. And once you're doing that, this is the danger of looking outward, because once you're doing that, everything else out there that the character disturbed person is doing takes on a whole different aura. Once you've got the self-loving down really well and you stay there and you refuse to budge from there, then every way that they try to drag you out of that happy place, that peaceful place, mm-hmm. becomes a clear and obvious tactic to take you out of heaven and throw you into hell. And your soul just wants to say, hey, no way.
What if you could fire the bank and recapture all that interest you're currently sending to the mortgage bank, credit card bank, or car loan bank? Well, you can. This week's episode of the Wealthy Wealthy Podcast is brought to you by Mark Willis and his firm, Lake Growth Financial Services. Become your own banker using the same bank on yourself wealth building financial strategy that I use. Mark Willis of Lake Growth Financial Services is a Sovereignty Academy faculty member, a personal friend, and trusted advisor who helps people like you and me learn how to become the bank versus paying one. Contrary to conventional wisdom, this banker strategy is better than paying cash or being completely debt-free. Your only regret will be that you didn't start using the strategy sooner. So head to christina.com/bank today and find out how this wealth building methodology can help you reach your financial goals and dreams without taking any unnecessary risks. christina.com/bank today. So word character, let's use the verb of love. You know, I think the word love is used as a noun or kind of a feeling, you know, and so it's, you know, that's, it's so like nebulous and
trivialized
and right. selfish in a way, like, you know, expectations or entitlement. I mean, we can do all sorts of things. And, but what about love as a verb? Like you said a few things that really spoke to me, because that's where I am now. Like my love as a verb, like who am I if I love? Like, what are my acts that the other, whoever I'm in relationship with, feels love through my actions, you know, that it conjures up that feeling as a result of my wanting through what I do.
Yes.
Love for me, like two prong approach. One is because I really want people to feel love. I think it's just missing, right? Everybody's right. protected. I don't know why that you're the psychologist. So I don't know why people, you know, can't love or don't love or whatever the case is. But I mean, I want others to feel love, you know, because and when you do, I think people are so deprived of love, like it just sits with them. When you're with them and you say, I see you, I understand you, I'm with you, I'm here for you, like I mean it, like I love you, and because I feel it and I want you to feel what I feel. So there's mm-hmm. that part of wanting the other person to feel it through the actions that they're receiving. Yeah. The other part of that, what I found for myself is like it's risky. I think, you know, it's risky to love because you might get hurt, right? So we deprive ourselves of real love because we're afraid to get hurt and going all the way. But what I'm here from my personal experience, there's no better place in life than just feeling love and feeling others feel loved. You know, it's like we're depriving ourselves, I think, of that magical, beautiful, awesome feeling
yeah.
out of fear of maybe there's pain attached, and there might be, but I just say it's still worth that possibility to feel this. So, but what's your definition for love?
So this is a great, you're asking some great questions. And this is the benefit of having these conversations, because it's what's behind the desire to have the conversation that really defines love in the first place. And that's why things just flow. And that's why anybody who listens to this is likely to get something very positive out of it. But you mentioned a lot of things, sentiments and positive qualities that often accompany love. But the closest thing I believe that you mentioned that comes to describing love in its essence is that impetus that you said was in you to discern just what love is. That impetus in all of us, whether we've done our best to quash it out or not, that eagerness to know love comes the closest to actually being love. There's an awful lot of things that sometimes accompany the quest that can seem like love in itself, from well-wishing to empathy to caring. All of those things often accompany love. But the work of discerning, trying to grow in love. In the Christian faith, we say trying to know God, because we say, at least we say it, that we believe that God is love. Well, most people don't act like that, unfortunately. But that sincere desire to know just exactly what the heck I'm talking about when I say I really want to love and feel love, I think that comes the closest to defining it that we're ever going to do in this life. And if we stay true to that, it doesn't mean that we're going to be spared any heartache. And that's why it's important to keep faith. That's the point I try to make in the Judas syndrome, which my heart breaks with the Judas syndrome, because the publisher on the Judas syndrome as much as they teased something out of me that I never thought that they would, they never saw it as a mass market book, so they didn't put it out there that way. And so people have to really scramble to find it. That's going to change with this last book of mine. That's going to change because I've rewritten it over and over and over again to include a more spiritual component to it. But that quest that you have, and that so many others have to discern just what this love, just what this life is really all about, comes the closest to defining love itself, I think.
Wow, thank you. And so to go back, I don't know exactly how you said it, but to be, let's now, so that's love is where it's like you just expressed it. How does love, like, let's say when, if you were going to describe a loving relationship, let's say a romantic relationship that's healthy, like what is, how does that look compared to one you would put that's not loving, right? Like,
okay,
contrast the two.
Yeah. So let me do that. That's a great question too. Let me do that by maybe enumerating all the things that it's not, because so many relationships these days are founded on what it's not. And I've written hundreds of articles on my blog at drgeorgesimon.com. I've written hundreds of articles about just this topic alone. It is not either just interest or desire. The most character-disturbed people on the planet know something of value when they see it. So when they see you and you bring something to the table, they can have a whole lot of interest in you and they can have a whole lot of desire for you. And that interest alone and that desire to be in your company and all like that, that is so frequently mistaken for love itself. In the worst cases, the most seriously disturbed characters on the planet are valuing Lee precisely because of what they anticipate they can get from you. whether it's just that you look good walking next to them and you build their ego, or whether you bring talent to the table or wealth or whatever, the most seriously disturbed characters will show a tremendous interest in you. And they will shower you and do their best to validate you and make you feel special because they want something. And often that is mistaken for loving regard. So it's not that. Which is why there were times when, at the outset of a relationship, people turned to the folks that they knew loved them, their closest friends and family, for vetting, for deep historical vetting of this prospective candidate's character. People don't do that anymore, and they're getting the results of that. I know that sounds maybe a little cold, but I mean, there are rules. There are rules of human nature. When we don't discriminate well and do our best to get some objective input, because, you know, when we're in the throes of something, somebody's got us all bowled over, you know, we can't think straight. We're feeling validated for the first time in our lives, and nothing's ever felt like this. When we don't take that careful discernment, there's a price to pay. And we earn that price. And it's part of our growth. We don't know that we're cruising for the bruising that we're going to get, but it's inevitable. And it's just all part of the deal. But we used to take some safeguards about that. And not that every, I'm not saying, believe me, that everything was great in the good old days. We've, human beings have always been human beings, and we've always had our problems. What I'm saying is that there were certain structures in our culture, in our society, and even within our family networks that were there on purpose because character had a level of importance it doesn't enjoy anymore. But because of the problems we're having because of it, the pendulum has to swing back. Mm-hmm. People are sick and tired of being sick and tired. They're sick and tired of having gone through relationship after relationship and still not having a satisfying one. People are done with it. Some people have checked out. Some people have said, you know, I'm kind of done with relationships. So the pendulum has to swing back.
Well, you see, I mean, what you say there when we're talking about what love isn't, and that's so good. I mean, the way you articulate that, the interest and desire is mistaken for love, because I can find it's easy to say, well, why would he be with me if he didn't love me?
Right.
You know, why is he still around if I'm, you know, if I'm not X, Y, Z? So it's easy to distill that down into love, because it's like, he wouldn't be here if he didn't love me. There's 10 million other people to choose from. So I can see how that can be very confusing if without that kind of rule in place, that those two things, it could be for self-interest, not, it has nothing to do with you, it has to do with them.
Right.
And the illusion of love.
We also had some other institutions that I guess you could pick a bone with. I mean, women always held the key, especially when it came to men and their character, because men want certain things. And women always had the power of no. You know, this is the great that goes on with respect to control over one's body, you know. And this is something that most men don't sit well with, that women have such incredible power of no. And one of the ways that was exercised in this discernment process is you know, I kind of know what you want, but you know what? You're going to have to prove to me that you're worthy. And that was kind of a civilizing influence. Well, in these days of more liberal, less judging, more relativistic times, we don't have to pay the kind of prices that we used to have to pay for the things that we want. I think sometimes we give ourselves too freely with hope and expectation. And what's easier? What's easier, to display charm, to seduce with tender words, or to be good? What's easier, to look good or to be good? And before, we used to vet. You had to demonstrate with your history, especially. It wasn't good enough to say, oh, you know what? That first marriage, she was crazy. She was just crazy. And that second one, once she cheated, always a reason. I had nothing to do with it. It's important to do the vetting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what you say, so that was one, interest and desire is mistaken for love.
Yes.
What else is love not?
It is not just being kind. It is not just validating, finding reasons to validate, affirming. And it's not even just being willing to commit something. In a relationship, especially in a marital relationship, or any intimate relationship holding a reasonable prospect of being long-lasting, It's all about the nature of the walk through thick and thin. And it's more even than the commitment. It's the nature of the walk itself. Do we want to head in the same direction? Do we want to assist one another in getting there? Do we want to be available to each other when we stumble? So many things about the quality of relationship that we just don't learn. Too much is given to us. It's an entitled, indulgent age. And here's the vicious cycle of it. As more and more character deficient people populated the society, all the structures and all of the institutions that were primarily designed to foster character growth became corrupted. And as they became corrupted, more and more character deficient people entered the society. And it was a classic vicious cycle, with more and more character disturbed people further corrupting the system, and with the corrupt system fostering more and more character disturbance. And it has to turn around, and how it will turn around is the same way. And because it always has to start with the human heart, that's my appeal. I mean, that's not my personal appeal. That's my desire. In whether it's something I compose literarily or otherwise, I'm trying to go here. Because that's where changes get made. If anything, I would encourage people more than anything else to really sit with what's going on in here. Even if you're in the throes of total enamoration, even if this person has the words, the sweetest words, and the most affirming style, I would ask, okay, so what's going on in here? How genuine does it feel? Is what you're experiencing, what does your heart tell you about? Would it be enough to carry you through a lifetime? Does it really satisfy where you want to go? We tend to idolize. We tend to think that this person, place, or thing will do it for us. That's the very nature of addiction and emotional dependency. They go together. You can't separate them. That's the very definition of addiction and emotional dependency, whether it's to a substance, a place, or a person. Doesn't matter. And whatever it is that we're getting at the outset of a relationship that seems so great, before long, we need more and more and more of it to feel good. And then all of a sudden, when it gets old for the other person and they stop giving it, and we're craving it, we realize how spiritually bankrupt we've become.
So if I hear what you're saying a few things. It's not desire and interest. It's not even the words of commitment, for example. Right. It's not.
Talk is cheap.
It's what it is, if I heard it correctly. It's really, let's see how. Like to put it in a verb, like the act of love, like true love, real love, healthy love that would probably make the world a better place, right?
Right. It's non-expectational.
Okay.
It's freely giving. Mm-hmm. It's freely keeping company. Mm-hmm. Working through. And growing in character, mm-hmm. helping one another, assisting one another in the, you know, a relationship is probably the greatest single potential instrument for building character of all. It's how we discern what love is all about. And these days, because of the nature of the times, it often takes a whole lot of trial. Whole lot of trial and error. Yeah. But that's what it's about.
Yeah. And you said it's the nature of the walk. I really like that that the love, maybe the again, I'm just trying to find the words to repeat back to you what I think I heard you say. It's like, it's the nature of the walk that the, I proclaim I love you up front that says, you know, I've vetted, hopefully have some history here, but that I proclaim, commit, promise, vow to do this walk with you. Mm-hmm. And that walk will be easy at times, that walk may not be easy at times, but I will go through the thick and thin here to do the work.
Yeah, but here's the other person's part of that. The other person's part of that is, okay, I hear the words, I hear the promise. Now, do I have any reason to suspect that this person really knows what they're talking about? Usually at certain ages, as well-intended as we are, we don't have a clue what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So the other person's part is, does this person really have a clue of what they're talking about? And if they do, what's the evidence? What's the evidence that they're at least on the path? Mm-hmm. And maybe I could call in some people I trust to look at the evidence more objectively than I can right now. Mm-hmm. And that helps to discern whether there's at least enough genuine love to have half a chance that this relationship is going to be a growing creative enterprise. Mm-hmm. As opposed to an eventual disaster and heartbreak.
Mm-hmm. And then the mindset, I guess, going into it in a way, on both sides, but is it, again, there's the selfish side that says, hey, I'm an individual. I like my ways. I like my life. I'm not changing. Take it or leave it. So there's a part of, you know, where it gets blurry a little bit is that, you know, to have a good amount of self-love and growth and a good place, there's a lot of that truth in there, like, hey, like, I really, you know, I'm bringing a good person to the table, right? I'm still wanting to grow and evolve and that type of thing. And it's kind of this mindset or point of view of like, I'm showing up as this, but I also want to expand, include someone else in my life and my choices, that you know, these choices are for both of us, not that anything that's going to hurt me by being in a relationship with somebody else, but it's beyond just my view of what's best for Christina. It's like, what's best for us type of mindset, as opposed to maybe two individuals, like I'm me, you, we're choosing to maybe share some space or life together, but ultimately we're kind of going by side, as opposed to, I don't know exactly what it was, but you know, going somewhere together.
Yeah. Walking together.
Yeah.
And toward the same goal, hopefully,
right.
Or at least similar goals. Mm-hmm. But you said something very interesting there about, you know, not just wanting for you, but for both of us. That broadens the picture. But you know what? The picture is actually even bigger than that, because we are all intimately connected. We're realizing this very big time as we impact the earth like we've never impacted it before. There's a whole lot more of us than there ever have been. And we're having impact. Matter of fact, that's the first commandment that I write about in my new book. You know, in my book, Character Disturbance, I wrote about these 10 commandments of character development. And they were fairly moralistic in tone, but a lot of folks wrote me processing them quite deeply, and we came to realize that there was inspiration behind those commandments and that the inspiration represented something much deeper. And so I've been rewriting this last book that is now tentatively titled Essentials for the Journey. And it's an in-depth look at these commandments that I wrote about growing in character emotionally, psychologically, behaviorally, and spiritually, because they all go together. I love the title of your blog, Wealthy, or, you know, this concept of wellness is truly a holistic enterprise. You can't be really healthy in one dimension and just be horribly unhealthy in another. It just doesn't work that way. And so the world needs healing, and it happens one relationship at a time, and good relationships happen one heart at a time. So it starts here with the individual heart. It extends to the relationship, but it's even bigger than that, what you mentioned. It's about how the impact that you bring to all the rest of it. We are in this together. We're connected in ways that is almost impossible, and yet at the same time breathtaking to discern. And so the question is, not just will our relationship grow us and take us to a better, more fulfilling, healthier place, but will we bring some growth, some positive creative energy into the world because of not just what we do individually, but because of the synergy between us? Mm-hmm. Will we as an entity, as a relationship, be part of the solution or part of the problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome.
And if you're on the computer watching porn, you're part of the problem. Right? Or rather than single out a single person, if we're both doing that together because we have both agreed to substitute momentary titillation for the ecstasy of real intimacy, we're still part of the problem.
Explain.
It all comes down to character. I'm getting really uppity about it. You know, it's my crusade. And I am not saying, but I am not saying that I got this all figured out, or that I don't have my own work to do all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that the first step, as they say in every recovery group, is correctly identifying what the issue is and admitting it at a deep level, not just with words, but really acknowledging to yourself, you know, this is the issue, and then tending to it. And, you know, in the 12-step groups, the second step is coming to believe in something bigger to guide you, and then turning yourself over to that something bigger, to have a value system, a guidepost that helps take you where your heart naturally wants to go anyway. And so many of those systems have failed us. So many religious institutions have completely failed us because they're comprised of men and women, broken women, men and women, mostly men.
Well, that hour went by fast. I would love, first of all, when is your new book coming out?
Everybody wants to know that. I think I'm within a couple of months to done. I'm rewriting chapter 5 right now. There were 3 chapters that were really a bugaboo for me. But I'm getting closer. And then the task is going to be to figure out how to put it out there. I'm tempted this time around I've been very lucky in some respects because I've been able to cut really decent deals with publishers, but I've also been at their mercy. And I don't want to be at their mercy anymore. And when I first published in Sheep's Clothing, all it took is putting it out there independently. And all those people who were hungry, who were experiencing this craziness, and who found this explanation in the introduction, they did all my work for me, you know, just like your friend, you know, you got to read this book. Well, that's how it works. So that's the next thing to discern, is how I'm going to put it out there. I'm very seriously leaning toward putting it out there independently again. Mm-hmm.
Well, what I would love to do is to have a follow-up conversation once you've published the book and do my part to help get it, to help, you know, make impact through the distribution of your wisdom.
Folks can get a sneak preview if they go to my YouTube channel, and I've got a playlist for the new Character Matters podcast. I used to be a live program on UCY TV before it went defunct. I'm taping all these shows in podcast form. I haven't put them out there on the major podcast platforms just yet, but I will. But they can go to the YouTube channel and look at the Character Matters playlist. And that's what we've been talking about lately, is these commandments. We're on the third one right now.
All right.
So they can get a sneak peek.
Perfect. And we'll do a follow-up podcast where we'll just talk about the 10 character commandments, because I'm curious.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. Well, let's just wrap up with a few final questions. And
Okay. My
first question that I like to ask is say, Christina, if you really, really knew me, you would know that. What's something that most people don't know about you?
That I'm always pondering what I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Tell me something, just tell me a little bit of a brag moment. What's something that, you know, you're just genuinely, internally really proud of?
That when I've been humbled, and believe me, many times I've had to be, that when I've been humbled, I didn't check out.
Yeah, right on. On the flip side of that, what would be, a failure or something, one of those moments where, you know, you probably learned a big lesson from it, but if you had to do it all over again, you would skip over that one.
Oh, gosh, I don't know that I would skip over anything, but one thing I'm not particularly proud of is that it usually takes so much to humble me.
You require a big 2x4. I relate.
Yes.
Yeah.
And my wife tells me that all the time. And it's so true. A big fat 2x4 upside the head.
Yeah. I'm with you on that one as well. All right. One final question that I like to complete by busting one big fat myth. Is there just a big lie out there that you'd like to call out from your point of view?
There are two big lies from traditional psychology. Yeah, I'll say it this way. I say this in rhyming little phrases in my training workshops. It's not so much that they don't see. The bigger problem is they see but disagree. And it's not that they're not aware enough. The bigger problem is they don't care enough. So stop trying to get others to see. That's what therapists do, and they waste their time, their energy, and their breath. Do the loving. Then you'll see.
Right on. Well, Dr. George Simon, man, I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours. Thank you so much for sharing today and being here. And like I said, saying yes to be on my program. And I look forward to your next book.
A clear pleasure. Enjoyed it immensely. We'll do it again sometime, I hope.
Let's do it. If you're inspired by today's show and you're the kind of person who likes to help others, there are some easy ways that you can help me. First, please subscribe to the Wealthy Wealthy podcast. By doing so, it helps both of us. You'll never miss an episode, and it helps me and my ratings. And if you're able to leave a review, hopefully 5 stars, even better. Finally, if you think your friends and family would enjoy the show, I invite you to share the Wealthy Wealthy podcast with everyone you know. If you have any questions, I'm here. You can email me at support@wealthywealthy.com, and I may even use your question or suggestion for a future podcast episode. Also, if you want to be motivated and inspired more regularly, connect with me on Instagram or LinkedIn at Christina Wise. That's KrissTinaWise. I believe we are all on this journey together towards finding our sovereignty and freedom. And I'd love to be part of your journey. I'd love to help you, and especially on the financial side. So learn more at sovereigntyacademy.com. As always, thank you so much for listening and being part of the Wealthy Wealthy community.